This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE, Fetter Syracuse, W201CD, Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio, Santa Cruz. You're listening to a talk by Robert Fisk, foreign correspondent of the London Independent. We continue.
Well, I think the real point, however, is that in the Middle East, many of our journalists are distorting the truth, either because we are afraid of criticisms from Israel and its supporters, or because we journalists prefer an easy life, unencumbered by hate mail and letters to the editor. Let's take the pejorative use of the word terrorist. Now, the mass murders of September the 11th may require a redefinition by those journalists, including myself, who normally abjure the word in Middle East reporting on the grounds that it is used exclusively about Arabs. But its overuse, almost as a punctuation mark in any discussion of the Arab-Israeli dispute, remains as poisonous as ever. It's difficult to explain to Arabs, for example, why the New York and Washington massacres were an act of terrorism, which it was, but why the massacre of up to 1,700 Palestinians in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps of Beirut between the 16th and 18th of September 1982 has never been called an act of terrorism by journalists or by governments. The death toll in Shatila, remember, was more than half that of the Twin Towers on September 11th. But we didn't call the killers terrorists. Was this strange omission of the word terrorism because the killers, members of the Christian Falangist militia, happened to be allied to Israel? Did it not qualify as an act of terrorism because most of the murderers were wearing Israeli Defense Force uniforms? Albeit with the acronym Sahal in Hebrew painted out. Or did it fail to meet the terrorism test because Israeli forces had surrounded the camp in 1982 and because Ariel Sharon, then of course Israel's defense minister, had sent the Falange into the camps? Not once, ever, has a Western newspaper called the mass murderers of Sabra and Shatila terrorists. Indeed, Israel's own Kahan Commission of Inquiry into the massacre, not a bad document, though flawed in some ways, a document which held Ariel Sharon personally responsible for the killings, called the killers soldiers. This is not an isolated example. When an Israeli reserve officer, Baruch Goldstein, massacred 29 Palestinians in a Hebron mosque, 25th of February 1994, he was not called a terrorist. CNN referred to him as deranged. Later, the Israeli ambassador in London, this is my favorite one, said that Goldstein was, quote, deranged by fanaticism. Psychologists among you can explain that to me afterwards. Other reports spoke of Goldstein as extremist and as a member of a Jewish underground group. See, underground has this resonance from the Second World War, the Polish underground, the French underground, something rather noble. Yet when Hamas took its inevitable and wicked revenge with a bus bomb in the Israeli town of Afula, CNN recovered its nerve. Reporter Bill Delaney told us it was an act of... No, Arab terrorism. You've got to get the two together. The end of the lecture, we'll do it again. Of far greater ethical significance was the cover of Newsweek magazine. I love Newsweek's front covers. Now, as you see, terror goes global, alluding to Osama bin Laden's international network of terror. Pretty accurate. This is February 19, 2001. They got that right. Okay. Beneath these words, however, as you can see, is a photograph of a Palestinian. He's wearing a kufiya, holding in his hands an automatic rifle, I think an M16. Now, readers might suppose, you might suppose, might you not, that this is part of the terror network. Indeed, you're obviously meant to believe this. But I was puzzled about this cover picture. I'd seen it before, you see. It was taken by Ilkka Jumanen of the Gamma Picture Agency in Paris. Jumanen lives now in New York, so I called him up from Beirut, and he confirmed the cover picture was his. I took the picture in the West Bank, he told me. It was a member of Tanzim, the Palestinian militia, at a Palestinian funeral. Thus, you see, a Palestinian gunman, armed and attending the funeral of a fellow Palestinian killed by Israelis, had been turned into a representative of global terror. That's what it says. Palestinians as a people, and the man on Newsweek's cover is very definitely a Palestinian, had been effortlessly transformed into enemies of the world. Just what Mr. Sharon wants. It wasn't the fault of the photographer that Newsweek's cover picture was a lie. The man whose face was covered by the kufiya, dangerous though he would be to the Israelis, has nothing to do with bin Laden or the lead story, in the magazine. Now, just as Ariel Sharon, Israel's prime minister today, of course, has been doing his best to link Yasser Arafat with bin Laden, journalists have gone out of their way to decontextualize Israel's role in the occupied territories. Indeed, once the State Department told its diplomats, it was actually a direct personal memo from Colin Powell, I thought of that today when I was looking at him, once they got the message that they were to stop using the word occupied in relation to the West Bank and Gaza, American journalists, many of them, followed this example. Henceforth, the land would be called disputed. As in Benjamin Netanyahu, this is Time magazine, Benjamin Netanyahu turns up the heat by okaying new houses in disputed territory. Disputed, of course, changes the reality. By deleting occupation from their lexicon, journalists erase the colonies illegally built for Jews and Jews only on Arab land. They erase the many Israeli checkpoints which still covered, as they do today, the West Bank and Gaza. You know, I was on a live radio interview in Beirut the other day, the perils of the mobile phone. I was in Ashrafieh, driving along, phone goes, BBC World Service, direct lines through to an Israeli spokesman, we're going to have a discussion about events in the West Bank. And the moment I referred to the occupied territories, the voice in Jerusalem, no, I'm not occupied. So I said, I see. So you mean the soldiers who stopped my car last week between Ramallah and Jenin, they were Swiss, were they? Or maybe they were Burmese. You see, disputed suggests an argument about land deeds or conflicting heritage claims, as CNN once memorably called them, failing to point out that Palestinians, many of them, have documents to prove land ownership, while many Israeli settlers believe that the man up there gave the land to them without a document, or with a very important document, but not one that goes through lawyers. There's a problem there, isn't there? The Associated Press, largest news agency in America, second largest in the world after Reuters, has now referred and constantly refers to the occupied lands not as occupied but as, quote, war won. You will never find the word occupied in AP Now. War won. Funny old word, isn't it? Very difficult contortion, sort of war won, war won. There must be something very frightening to avoid to use a silly phrase like that. The contorted expression, of course, places an almost victorious facade upon the illegality of occupation. I've been searching in vain to find the first use of the phrase settlements and settlers in relation to Israel's occupation. You see, the Israeli settlements are occupied. They're on occupied land, and they're occupied as colonies, and their inhabitants are colonists every bit as much as the French colonized Algeria. When I made this point in my own newspaper, the London Independent, a stream of letters accused me of deliberately trying to make a parallel between Palestinian terrorism and the FLN's ultimately successful 1954-62 War of Independence against France. I was indeed making that parallel. Interestingly, Sharon has himself compared all of Israel to Algeria under French rule. Weren't shown this in any newspaper here, were you? It was revealed in a very important interview in the French magazine L'Express in the Christmas of 2001, when he said that he told President Chirac of France that, quote, this is Sharon speaking, you've got to understand that we here, we are like you in Algeria. We have no other place to go, and besides, we have no intention of leaving. The French word for a settler is colon, accurately representing what the Israeli settlers in the West Bank and Gaza are doing, colonizing. But today, even that tame word settlement is disappearing in British and American journalism. CNN, in one of its most recent contributions to journalism, sent out an instruction to correspondents telling them that Gilo, the Jewish settlement built largely on Arab land south of Jerusalem, is to change its definition. I have the CNN memo, and I will now quote it to you. Quote, we refer to Gilo as a Jewish neighborhood on the outskirts of Jerusalem, but on land occupied by Israel, built on land occupied by Israel in 1967, we don't refer to it as a settlement. Now it happens that Gilo is a settlement or colony built for Jews only on occupied and largely Palestinian land. CNN at least got the occupied bit right. It's partly owned by Palestinians in the neighboring Christian village of Beit Jala. Gilo is Hebrew for Jala. It was constructed in violation of UN Security Council resolutions 242 and 338, and we have to remember, don't we, that we have to obey UN resolutions, and it was against international law. It has also been incorporated into the enlarged municipality of Jerusalem, in itself part in illegal annexation. But CNN's little lie about neighbourhood again transforms the reality. You see, neighbourhood, like some small suburb of Boston, is a cosy, friendly neighbourhood. Why on earth would anyone attack a neighbourhood? To fire guns in a neighbourhood is obviously the act of madmen, mindless terrorists, evil men. There can't be a reason. You see, as the viewer is spared the ultimate reality of the settlement, so Palestinian violence, however reprehensible, becomes inexplicable. No need for the wise. Of course, I asked for a comment from CNN, called up Atlanta from Beirut, and in fairness to CNN, I must give you their reply. The spokesman said, quote, "We really don't want to talk about this." And I can well see why. The BBC has also recently advised its reporters in the Middle East, another little instruction of which I have a copy, to use the phrase, quote, "targeted killings," unquote, for the murder of Palestinians by Israeli death squads, preferring this to assassinations, which, so thinks the BBC, might be reserved for more important folk than the suspected Palestinian gunmen and bombers on Israel's hit list. But it just happens, doesn't it? It just happens that targeted killings, quote, is Israel's own expression for its killing of selected Palestinians, and I don't believe the BBC was unaware of this. As the growing list of totally innocent civilians killed during these attacks demonstrates, and do not forget the growing list of Israeli civilians killed in wicked suicide bombings, but we're talking here about the Palestinians, those targeted killings do include women and children. The word targeted is therefore highly misleading. I was amused to see a BBC advertisement for a television documentary about the end of the peace process. Bit more exclusion of linguistic narrative here. If we could just have the lights down, Tom, just briefly here. Here's the programme. It's called When Peace Died. On the left, of course, you'll recognise the photograph of the Palestinian, appalling photograph, with the blood of one of the butchered Israeli soldiers, reserve soldiers, on his hands. The killing, of course, lynching of two Israeli reserve soldiers in Ramallah police station. On the right, the iconic picture of little Mohammed al-Dura just before he was shot dead by Israeli troops. These advertisements to the BBC are sent along to us by the BBC to my newspaper. So here is the back of the card, which is actually much more instructive. Now, I'll read it to you. See what's wrong with it. Two images captured the hatred that has destroyed the peace process in the Middle East. Mohammed, the boy from Gaza, shielded by his father, but still dying under a hail of bullets. And the brutal murders of two Israeli soldiers by a Palestinian mob. Yeah, you got it. You see, I'm sorry, there have been a few audiences that I'd just point it out a bit more. The problem here, as you can see immediately, is who killed little Mohammed. Now, you know, it's most Israelis I've met believe, and certainly many Israeli MPs believe, and most of the journalists, that Mohammed al-Dura was shot by Israeli troops, although some of them may not have known he was behind the wall at the time. But once again, the narrative of the Palestinian suffering is cut short, whereas the full story of the Israeli murders is there. It's ironic, I think. Tom, you can put the lights up again. I'll finish with the machine here now. It's ironic, I think, that among the exceptions to the grotesque and misleading journalism coming out of the Middle East, there are a few very brave Israeli reporters who question the morality of Israel's actions with a ruthlessness which is rare in any European publication and almost totally absent in the United States. Among the most courageous and eloquent of these Israeli journalists are Gideon Levy and Amira Haas in Haaretz. I know many of you read Haaretz. Those who don't, you should. Amira recently, she and I were talking about what journalism is meant to be about. And I, of course, was waffling on in my Brit way. It's about writing the first page of history, the only, you know, independent witness, etc., etc. She said, "No, Robert, you're wrong." She said, "The definition of journalism is to monitor the centres of power." As good a definition as I've ever heard for our profession. But it raised an important question. How can Amira Haas say things that her American counterparts shy away from? Why can she say things which far better paid and supposedly more powerful American journalists cannot? At least not without the weasel words that I've been talking about, which immunize them from criticism, which they hope will do so. Needless to say, Haas not only puts us to shame, but Arab journalists as well. For out in the arid wastes of Arab journalism, there is as little interest in serious investigation of the Middle East conflict as there is in the United States. As I know to my cost. Excuse me. I've been abused as a liar by Damascus Radio in 1982 after describing at first hand Syria's bloody repression of thousands killed in Hama, February of 82. In Egypt, I've been called a black dog pecking at the corpse of Egypt. This in the Cairo press for saying that Egypt's elections are rigged. In President Mubarak's last presidential election, he got 98.8%. Not, of course, up to the standards of Saddam's 100%. I should tell you that I've uncovered in my researches through the old Lebanese newspapers that President Kouatli of Syria 40 years or 50 years ago got 110%. He was so stunned by the result that he fired his interior minister and reduced it to 99. Better than Mubarak, not as good as Saddam. Anyway, I was a black dog pecking at the corpse of Egypt. I'll show you now what happened when I wrote about a former British special branch officer called Ian Henderson. He's actually Scottish, who was running the Bahrain interrogation centre where torture was taking place. This is the small Arab island of Bahrain, before the old emir died. And I'll show you what happened. Akhbar al-Halij, anybody here who can... Oh, can you come and help me hold this poster up? Akhbar al-Halij, published this picture. Oh, it's the other way around. Hold it up as high as you can. There we are. Of three dogs. Black dog at the top is the BBC. Here's Bob. Look at this, all this cash we could possibly have if we wanted it. Down here is Christopher Walker of the Times. Not a totally inaccurate picture of him. One more to do. Just drop it on the ground, it's okay. I'll let you have a closer look at Bob. I love cartoons and newspapers. I always wanted to be a cartoonist. There you are, you see. I have to tell you that the nightmare dentures are pretty accurate. But the problem is this. This dog is meant to be rabid. And rabid dogs have to be exterminated, which is why I don't believe for a moment that this cartoon was a joke. It was a threat. Thank you. Just drop it on the ground. I'll be awesome. Thanks. In all the Middle East, however, I think nothing quite surpasses our journalistic desire to humour Turkey by obfuscating the reality of the 20th century's first genocide, the deliberate killing of 1.5 million Christian Armenians, most of them slaughtered in 1915 by the Ottoman Turkish authorities. No serious academic, except those holding chairs funded by Turkey, disputes the fact, and anyone who doubts them should read the recently published and excellent Encyclopedia of Genocide by Israel's foremost Holocaust scholar, Israel Charney. Indeed, my own paper, The Independent, now refers to the Armenian Holocaust with a capital H, just as it does to the Jewish Holocaust, of course. Winston Churchill actually called the Armenian suffering a Holocaust in the 1920s. This is what Hitler remembered when he turned to his generals and said, "Who now remembers the Armenians?" It's a very important historical fact. Much of Israel Charney's horrifying documentation comes from 1915 editions of the New York Times. It was then a great scoop for the New York Times, though of course a terrible one to read and see the pictures of. Recently, however, these appalling and bloody events have been almost universally referred to by journalists as disputed. My favourite word it's becoming, like the disputed West Bank and Gaza. And most extraordinary of all, the New York Times, the paper which 86 years ago did more to publicise these massacres than any other paper in the United States, has done its bit to discredit the tragedy. In April of 1998, for example, the New York Times' Stephen Kinzer wrote a report about the 70,000 Armenians who live in present-day Turkey. Here is a key paragraph from his report. I will try to resist sticking my hand up when I come to the bits that are very odd. Relations between Turks and Armenians were good during much of the Ottoman period, but they were deeply scarred by massacres of Armenians by that pro-Ottoman forces in eastern Anatolia carried out in the spring of 1915. Details of what happened then are still hotly debated. Remember the hotly debated, it's one of our favourite phrases. But it is clear, I'm quoting, it is clear that vast numbers of Armenians were killed or left to die during forced marches in a burst of what is now called ethnic cleansing. Just like that. I still read this paragraph with a sense of shock. What did Kinza mean by deeply scarred? Relations between Turks and Armenians came to a virtual end in 1915 because tens of thousands of Armenians were no longer alive to have relations with. And note the intriguing phrase pro-Ottoman forces, a weasel word that effectively avoids the use of the words Turks or Turkish. Most incredible of all is Kinza's assertion that the details are hotly debated. Turkey may use its lobby groups to lie about the genocide, and the Turkish government still tries to cover up the massacres as the side effects of civil war. But for the New York Times to present the Armenian Holocaust as a subject of serious dispute is as insulting to Armenians as it is for Jews to hear the facts of their Holocaust disputed or denied. Note how Kinza, by the way, talks about vast numbers, thus avoiding the key figure of 1.5 million, and how ethnic cleansing takes the place of a much more appropriate word, genocide. Another of Kinza's articles, written from the Armenian capital of Yerevan, even carried the headline, Armenia never forgets. Maybe it should. Here's Mr. Kinza's latest contribution. This is the New York Times of April this year, last year. He's writing about genocide museums in general. Washington already has one major institution, the United States Holocaust Museum, that presents facts which are incontrovertible. But of course, the Armenian Genocide Museum is showing details that are still a matter of intense debate. I got a fascinating email the other day from an Armenian man living in Toronto in Canada. He'd read an article I'd written in The Independent about what I referred to as, and what The Independent called, the Armenian Holocaust. He was a little bit upset, he said, because in the Toronto Globe and Mail, which had syndicated the same article, it did not use the words Armenian Holocaust, which had been edited out. As he said in his letter to the editor of the Toronto Globe and Mail, Mr. Fisk referred to Holocaust while your version calls it the mass murder of the Armenians. They'd changed the words. So, of course, I called up London immediately to our syndication department because everybody who syndicates, takes syndication from our newspaper, signs an undertaking not to change the bloody words. Well, they came back to me later and said, we've got them, Bob. They changed the words, but they didn't even ask to buy the article. They stole it. Fortunately, we have financial penalties for people who steal our articles, so we turned a dollar, but I wish it hadn't been done. You know, when you look at all of this, I ask the same questions as I do about the coverage of the 1982 Sabra and Shatila massacre. Why do we journalists try so hard to avoid the truth, to extenuate, to dissimulate, to cover up? Is it because Turkey is an important political and military ally of the United States? Because it's a valuable purchaser of American weaponry? Is it because Turkey is an ally of Israel, or because it has a powerful lobby group in Washington? Let's go back to the Arabs, and indeed the Muslims in general. I want to give you some small examples now about how Muslim anger comes about. I'm going to take you back to 1993, because that was the year in which I made a three-part documentary film for the Discovery Channel in America, and for Channel 4 television in Britain, called Beirut to Bosnia. It attempted to find out why an increasing number of Muslims had come to hate the West. It was an attempt to alert people that something was coming. In fact, the subtitle was Beirut to Bosnia, How Muslims Are Coming to Hate the West. I tell you, the New York Times mocked the title, finding it totally irrelevant. Now, I'm going to start by showing you a clip of film which we made in Bosnia, in which you will see life in Sarajevo, and also particularly you will see Bosnian Muslim refugees being thrown from their homes. The issue here, of course, is that, you won't see the refugees thrown from their homes, you'll see the refugees absent. The issue here, of course, is about what happens to a population when they are thrown out of their own homes. I'd like to show the film now, if we can go ahead. Tom, we're ready to roll. Remember that film was subtitled, How Muslims Come to Hate the West? We did many other things in the film. It cost $1 million in all. It was made on real film. We followed not just a Palestinian's home in Israel, what is Israel now, what was Palestine, which had been taken over by a Jewish family in 1948. We went to the Jewish family's home in Poland, where they had been driven from their home by the Nazis. Shortly after this series aired on Discovery here in the States, however, a series of pro-Israeli lobby groups, including Camera,
the Camera Media Resources Centre, bombarded the channel with complaints. Joseph Ungar wrote to complain that for me to say that Israel confiscates or occupies land and builds huge Jewish settlements on Arab land was twisted history. Twisted history. To say that the Falangist militia had been sent into Sabra and Shatila by Israel was an egregious falsehood. One letter said that Fisk was Henry Higgins with fangs. Those of you who like My Fair Lady will know the reference. I was drooling venom into the living rooms of America. These claims, of course, were totally false, but Discovery rang me in Beirut to say they were receiving even more letters condemning the films from lobby groups. Then director Mike Dutfield and I heard that Discovery had cancelled the second showing of the series in America. Bunting, the senior vice president of Discovery, then wrote a letter when Dutfield asked him if it was true. And I will quote to you what he said. Please don't laugh till the end. He denied, you see, there was any cancellation. Given the reaction to the series upon its initial airing, we never scheduled a subsequent airing. So there's not really an issue as to any scheduled re-airing being cancelled. When I read those words, ladies and gentlemen, I felt ashamed to be a foreign correspondent. Interestingly, the condemnation and abuse that I regularly receive, far outnumbered, I should add, by literally many thousands of emails praising the independence coverage of the Middle East from Jerusalem as well as Beirut, the condemnation has increased significantly since the Independent became available through its website, www.independent.co.uk, to internet users throughout the world, especially America. Many American readers have lamented to us what one of them called our lobotomized journalistic coverage. A number of letters of support, I must say, also came from Jewish Americans. But the mailbag contained the usual vitriol. An American law student at a British university wrote to tell me that I was an evil fucking man. A remark he withdrew when I called him at his college and threatened to bring the police round for threatening behaviour. He'd been foolish enough to put his phone number on the email. Another letter, anonymous this time, began, "To Mr. Shit Fisk, you are what you are, an evil, mad, evil anti-Semite. Your judgment day will come." One of my most recent messages, again anonymous and this time thrown into the garbage bin, contained the accusation that my mother must have been Adolf Eichmann's daughter. Eichmann, of course, being the leading SS Nazi who sent so many hundreds of thousands of Jews to their murder in Auschwitz. My mother, Peggy, I should add, died in 1998 after a long battle with Parkinson's, but during the Second World War, she was a radio repair operator in frontline RAF air bases in southern England under Nazi attack, repairing radios on Spitfires. So we ask a number of questions. What's been happening to us in the months since September the 11th, 2001? You know, we spent decades preaching to the Third World, to China, to the Soviet Union, to Black Africa, and of course to the Arabs, about the need for law, democracy, human rights, fair trials. But the moment our glittering, I always like to have these little deus ex machina at these points to keep you awake. But the moment our glittering towers are struck, we tore up all those old lectures, imprisoned hundreds on suspicion, brought prisoners drugged and blindfolded to Guantanamo Bay, bombed the poorest country in the world, killed thousands of its citizens, and now we may be set to kill thousands more. I visited the home of a man called Ziad Jarrah in 2001. He was the Lebanese suicide pilot who came from a village in the Bekaa Valley of Lebanon. This was the pilot of the plane which crashed in Pennsylvania after those American passengers had so courageously stormed onto the flight deck. His parents were middle class, his mother a school teacher, his father a civil servant in the Lebanese government. By chance, I even knew his uncle, who was a bank manager in a town called Shtura. The family desperately wanted to believe that their son was an innocent passenger on the plane. His father wept in front of us, but I discovered he did know the truth. His son had a girlfriend, a Turkish girl, who was to have met his parents the summer before to announce their engagement. In the end, she travelled alone to meet them, a very strange arrangement in Lebanon, because Jarrah suddenly announced that he was too busy with flight training here in the United States. You bet he was. His father told me he sent him $2,000 3 days before September 11th. And on the 10th, the day before the International Crimes Against Humanity, Ziad Jarrah rang his parents to thank them for the money. I suspect it was used to buy airline tickets. He had been to Afghanistan, it transpired, for 6 weeks. He had been non-political before. However, as a boy, he had been trapped in Beirut by the 1982 invasion, spending weeks under shellfire. Had this touched him, as it did so many others at the time? After all, the Lebanese Hezbollah were born in 1982. What are we to learn of the personal reasons for the crimes against humanity of September the 11th? Not much. The middle-class murderers left only one infantile statement. Their message was their deed. But it came from the Middle East. The message came from a land that has been deceived and mistreated and humiliated for decades. Was the world really changed forever? I don't think so. Perhaps America was changed. But why should the world be changed? In Israel's invasion of Lebanon, 17,500 people, almost all of them civilians, were killed in just 3 months. More than five times the death toll in the World Trade Center. Up to 20,000 Syrians were slaughtered in Hama by the Syrian army in February of 1982. Did the world change? No, not at all. No tears were shed. No candles were lit. No one here would even remember the dates. A few perhaps, but not many. There were no memorial services. And the world did not change. I heard the US Secretary of State, Colin Powell, telling us from Louisburg University in the autumn of 2001, "Never again can we look up into the pale blue sky and see an airliner and think the same way about it." I think this is absolute rubbish. I sit on my balcony in Beirut and see endless airplanes flying over the autumn sky, and they land at Beirut Airport. And I fly on a lot more airplanes than Secretary Powell, and they land at my destination. I think, you know, without in any way belittling the horror and the evil, yes, it was evil, of that terrible day, I do sometimes wonder whether America's concentration on that one day, to the point where we cannot discuss the whys, isn't becoming a form of dangerous self-absorption. Can we journalists then ignore the abuse and the lobby groups and the attempt to soft-pedal in our reporting about the Middle East? White House spokesman Ari Fleischer's remark last October that, I quote, "the press is asking a lot of questions that I suspect the American people would prefer not to be asked or answered," carried its own ominous implications. And when the head of CNN instructed his reporters in the autumn of 2001 not to say too much about the hundreds, indeed the thousands, of Afghan civilian casualties of American bombing because this might provide propaganda for the Taliban, it was, I think, the most shameful comment made by a Western news head in recent times. Ladies and gentlemen, at a time when your country, or the country of most of you, looks as if it's about to go to war, for reasons that I believe, and I think a lot of you suspect, are not true ones, I'd like to make an appeal. Let's stop saying that September the 11th, 2001, changed the world. Let's not say disputed when we mean occupied, neighborhood when we mean colony, ethnic cleansing when we mean genocide. Let's always ask the why questions. And let's do what the Americans used to tell their journalists to do and should do at this critical time. Let's tell it how it is. Thank you for your patience.
What is going on with this US-British pairing?
What you mean is, what is Mr. Blair doing?
Yeah.
You need any coalition, Bulgarians, Romanians, who will be very good for you, yeah. Well, look, mercifully, I don't live in Britain under Mr. Blair's rule. As you probably know, about 80% of British people are against the war, so the majority of Britons are represented by President Chirac of France. Look, this is what my colleagues in London tell me, because they all talk the same question, but I'm only passing it on as second hand. I cover the Middle East, it's quite enough without Mr. Blair. First of all, Blair obviously has this image, this idea, that he will be the link man between Europe, well, old Europe or new Europe, whatever, and Washington. That he will somehow hold the two sides together. The transatlantic alliance is what Britain is famous for. And it's true that, excuse me, after Chancellor Schroeder was very rude about America in the run-up to the Chancellor's elections. Normally, after a successful election, the Chancellor of Germany goes to the President of France, because the Franco-German axis is meant to be at the spine of the European Union. He went to London to ask Mr. Blair to call Washington and say sorry. So, you see, up to a point, Blair has a point. Now, there are other reasons. We Brits need America's help to keep the peace going in Northern Ireland. Without Clinton, I don't think there would have been a Good Friday Agreement. With a very large number of soldiers committed to Bosnia, we need the Americans to stay in Bosnia. We need them for transportation, communication, protection, etc. I rather suspect, however, this is a little bit small time. I think what actually happens is this. If you're the Prime Minister of Britain, and you've got the usual cabinet splits and people wanting to do this to you, it's not so bad in the White House, but at least you try 10 Downing Street, you've got a railway system that's collapsing, a tube system, which has got tube trains which were built before the Second World War. You've got an absolutely disgusting health system, an education system that's falling to bits. What better than to become an international statesman? Flying Concorde or first class, to have Marines saluting you as you go to Camp David or the White House. You fly off to see President Pervez Musharraf to try and keep peace between India and Pakistan. And you begin to become a statesman. And then you believe that you walk the path that destiny dictates. Blair made a comment in Parliament a couple of days ago that he'd far rather be unpopular as a Prime Minister for doing the wrong thing than to court publicity and know he was doing the wrong thing. When you have that kind of self-confidence, you have to wonder what job you're in. It was interesting to see the other day that the British Minister for Europe lectured the Europeans in Brussels along the lines that it was not the job of British governments to follow public opinion, but to guide them. And it did occur to me that the German word for guide is Führer. As in Reiseführer, travel guide, right? Look, the whole relationship between the United States and Israel is a taboo subject, as Edward Said once said. It's the one taboo left in America. You can talk about gays, lesbians, blacks, but not about that relationship. If you talk to Israelis, they can be very, very frank about the situation. They do have immense influence in this country. Many people complain about the Jewish lobby. My reaction is, they work hard. Arabs should stop complaining. If they want a lobby, they should have a lobby and work hard. I'm sorry, I'm sick to death. I'm sick to death of hearing people complaining about the Israeli lobby. Now, where the problem comes here is, moving back a bit, I think it's more about the American system. Now, I'm not an expert on American governance, but many Americans, I come here every 3.5 weeks on average. One said to me the other day in San Diego that there's a kind of hoax democracy, that you elect your House of Representatives member, but the moment he arrives at the House of Representatives, he has to represent the groups that funded his election. Not just the Israeli lobby, but the gun lobby, the tobacco lobby. And it's very interesting that when you have these anti-war movements, which do represent obviously quite a lot of Americans, there is very rarely, if ever, a single congressman or congresswoman there. In other words, the representatives are divorced from the people when there isn't an election. In this context, it's very easy for individual lobbying groups. By the way, Mark Twain complained about the system of lobbying in Washington. I don't know if you realize that. It's very easy for an Israeli lobby, for example, to exert enormous and disproportionate interest and influence. And I think the problem here is that if you add to this lobby the system of I'm trying to think of the right word. It's more than pressure. It's intimidation against anyone who dares to criticize Israel. And there are Israelis and Jewish Americans who entirely support what I'm saying. If you have this unconditional influence and in some cases bullying of people who dare to criticize Israel and criticize the Arabs, well, of course, we do. I do. We should. You end up in a situation where many people are frightened even of talking about the subject. If you're called an anti-Semite, it is a deeply distressing thing. I've got kind of used to it now. I've been called things by the Arabs. If you work in the Middle East, you've got to take the sticks and stones. But in a country which has been rightly educated about human rights, even if it doesn't always practice it, and where the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust I'm talking about, carries such enormous weight, and I think it should. It was the greatest, and certainly numerically the greatest, but the most evil crime of the last century. I think that when groups start to use this history, this terrible history, in order to intimidate people into silence, there is a big problem. And I think there's no doubt... I would say, I would add, since more than half the talks I give in America are organised by Jewish Americans, that among the very few people who are speaking out for the truth, and among people here who protect and defend me, are Jewish Americans. These people have to speak out on even more dangerous terms than you or I might have to in trying to say, look, the truth, the truth, the truth. You'll know, read Tikkun, Rabbi Lerner's magazine. I'm sure you do anyway, but you should. If you don't, have a look at it, it's good. The problem here, you see, is that Israel has fallen into the habit of using the history of the Holocaust again and again to silence criticism. A very well-known British Jewish historian wrote to Menachem Begin at the height of the siege of Beirut in 82, when Begin was saying, I am attacking Beirut, I feel I am advancing upon Berlin. You know who was in the bunker, of course, in Beirut, don't you? Our old friend who's now in Ramallah. And this historian wrote to Begin and said, please, please stop using the Holocaust. I was once actually, after 82, when the Israelis withdrew from Beirut, they opened a liaison office in Lebanon, which was going to be the embassy if there was peace. Of course, there wasn't. And its official was called Bruce Kashdan. Nice guy, knew him very well. He used to be the Israeli representative for Ireland as well, which is where I have a home. And I was talking to him one day after Sabra Shatila, and I said, Bruce, I have a question for you. What would Anne Frank have said if she'd walked into Sabra and Shatila with me? I had the Diary of Anne Frank was the first book that I read as a very little boy after my parents taught me, not in school but at home, to read. And of course I immediately, even as a little boy, understood the morality behind this book, because Anne Frank believed that whatever else, all human beings were basically good. Now she may not, as she was dying of typhus in Buchenwald, have maintained that brave view of the world. But I nonetheless said, Bruce, what would she have said? And he stopped for a minute and he said, I think she would have found it too confusing to understand. And I said, no, Bruce, I don't think so. I think I know very well what Anne Frank would have said, and so do you. And I think you see that there are so many Jewish Americans and British Jewish people who, for example, are coming to Lebanon saying, I want to see Kana, I want to see what happened in Sabra Shatila. I know one young woman in America, for example, Jewish American, who came to Lebanon, saw Sabra Shatila, and was so moved that she now teaches every year in the Bourjal Brajni Palestinian camp, and also goes to Gaza as a human rights worker. My feeling is that the way out of the lobby, the Israeli lobby, and the whole business of the failure and the inability to talk about the American-Israeli connection will be broken down eventually by the bravery of Jewish Americans, not by outsiders, the like of, you know, journalists or Brits or anyone else. And given the inability of so many Americans to talk about the Middle East through their fear, not by them either. I remember at Princeton some months ago, I'd given a talk, and afterwards the great and the good of Princeton invited me to a fine banquet with fine French wines, thank God they weren't California. And we were sitting on the table, and this lawyer who was there, it was a Washington lawyer, said, I think you're wrong about the, you know, Americans being frightened. The problem about reporting the Middle East is the journalists. So I said, so what do you think about the occupation of the West Bank? I don't want to get into that. Quite apart from the responsibility which the British government and, of course, the French government bear for the whole tragedy of the Middle East after the First World War, I think the problem is that we created most, if not all, the dictators of the Middle East. Saddam was our man. Gaddafi was our man. The Foreign Office supported Nasser. We love King Abdullah, even if he doesn't speak Arabic as well as he speaks English. Sometimes we adore President Bashar Assad. He comes with asthma to London. But all these people are supported by us, unless they nationalise the Suez Canal or help the IRA or invade Kuwait, in which case we bomb them. But otherwise, we want you to have dictators. The problem at the moment, I think, over Iraq is not that you shouldn't be liberated. Is that I don't think the purpose of this war is to liberate you. I think it is to merely find someone else who will be more obedient to us to rule you, because we don't want democracy in the world. The problem is that all the hope that has been held out to the people of Afghanistan is falling to pieces now in warlordism, drugs, banditry and rape under the new American success story. I fear very much for what the future of Iraq is actually going to be under the Americans. It might be better for some or more than the usual amount than living under Saddam. But the real problem is that I don't think the liberation is for the reasons it is being stated to be for. The other day when I was in George Mason University, I was castigated because of the questioning. Two-thirds were women and one-third were men, and this wasn't equal enough. And I said, I prefer women asking questions. What the hell? But I'm going to make it a bit better now because we have more men than women, so please, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Fisk, for a truly enlightening talk. I have a question for you. Can you please comment on whether the antagonism that apparently exists between the, quote, Muslim world and the U.S., or the West, actually, is just propaganda that journalists use to divide the world into us versus them, like what happened during the Cold War? Or would you say it is an actual reality? And is there really a clash of civilizations taking place, as some people would claim?
Whew. I don't like Mr. Huntington's book. Quite apart from the mistakes about Lebanon in it. Look, I'm still splitting my own mind about this. I re-edited this old film, old now, I mean 9 years ago, which you saw bits of tonight. And listening to my own commentary, what I wonder do Muslims have in store for us? Watch out. Remember when I was in that ruined mosque? How could I have known then its appalling application to September 11th? You know? When I look at the film, I think, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there is something. Maybe then I spotted something, and being a nice liberal person, I then didn't believe it, right? I don't think there's a clash of civilizations. I think there are people who would like there to be a clash of civilizations and who would like the New York Times constantly to carry stories which suggest that there are, without, of course, moving out of the liberal vein and suggesting there should be. You know, I think there on the, if you move back from it, you look at the history, as I said in the film, the history of the Middle East and what's happened to it. Oh, the Muslim world, but we're talking mainly about the Arab world, and Iran as well, and Afghanistan, of course, and Pakistan up to a point. You see everything that happened to it. Is it surprising that if you bash and bash and bash and bash at something, it'll bang back at you? Not because it's a clash of civilizations, but because what can you do otherwise without democracies, without a real voice in the world, with only one country saying, this is the theme? You know, one of the great problems when you're in the Middle East in dealing with American foreign policy, for example, is not that it's just unfair and biased, it's that it works on the principle that every human being in the world wants to be an American. Now, sometimes when I'm in the Middle East and I see the queues of Arabs round and round the embassy waiting for green cards and visas, one might be tempted to believe that it was true. But it's not. And I think that if you, you know, we have to include in this the British and the French, you know, Lord Balfour, Lawrence of Arabia. We told a lot of lies to the region. The Americans have taken over the lying now, but we told a lot before it. And I think that this builds up a residue of suspicion and fear. Violence comes principally through fear, not through aggrandizement or aggression, per se. The president of this country is building up plenty of fear. There are more threats and warnings uttered again about bombings and suicide attacks from President Bush than there are from Osama bin Laden. And it's happening in Britain now. We're being told there's going to be bombs on the underground, there's going to be suicide bombs, flying planes into Canary Wharf. And, you know, my editor says the same thing. What is this? Where is this coming from? You know, we have to be a little bit more self-controlled. We're supposed to be brave people. We don't have to go around living in fear. But if we can be made to fear the Muslim world, we too will get angry and want to strike. You know, there was an incident in Austin, Texas 2 days ago. I was making an interview with one of these nice liberal little radio stations, which I listened to by three people. Oh, it's TV, actually. And you're all agreeing with each other, which is the terrible thing about left-wing radio stations. Everybody agrees, and it's so boring. And suddenly, from behind the camera, came the cameraman and said, I'm glad you blame Britain, but I'll tell you who's to blame, and I'll leave out all the expletive delete. It's the Arabs, 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 they're medieval, they want to, you know. Suddenly, this guy exploded. It was only the second Bush supporter I've come across in the last 3 months. But this guy was out of control. And in fact, one of the ladies who had arranged the lecture series said, "Who is this guy?" I said, "I don't know, but I want his name. He's going in the Independent. My second Bush supporter, you know." But the fact of the matter is that if people can be made to believe in fear, then they will start. I think one of the reasons why the Israelis can be so brutal to the Palestinians is that they've been brought up in fear. In some cases, you may say accurately so. If you listen to the speeches of Arab leaders, and you're an Israeli, I think maybe I would feel fear, but not as much as this. So I don't think there's a clash of civilizations, but there are people who would like there to be. As a Brit in Europe, or as a European as I begin to think of myself, you know, we have this lovely common currency in most of the bloody place, but not in London. The Muslim world and the Jewish world of Israel are our neighbours. They are not America's neighbours. And they never will be. America's on the other side of the world. The problem, I think, for Europeans now is that we're not unified. Look at Bosnia. What a mess Bosnia was. And we needed the Americans, of course. But that we've got to insist on having a role in peacemaking in the Middle East, because we pay a lot of the money for the Middle East peace process, which is then squandered, of course. But we're not allowed by the Americans to have a real say. The Americans have screwed it up in the Middle East, totally. They may not know it, but they have. I'm talking about the administration. Don't say Britain supports America. Mr. Blair supports America, right? But in this case, we have to do something, because we cannot allow US foreign policy to poison the relations between Europeans and our neighbours, be they Jews or Muslims, because the fault line runs... Bosnia, there you are, right in Europe. I don't believe there should be, could be, or will be actually a clash of civilizations, but there are people who want there to be. I think there's a problem among Americans who... I'm not going to tell you to oppose the war. You can go off and fight in it if you want, but... no, I don't really want you to do that, but... I keep going to sort of academic meetings in universities in America. They're very interesting because I don't know that much about America. I'm learning fast. And they keep talking about activism, and they want to build bridges to other academics and activists and mainstream newspapers, which are irredeemable. And I don't understand, when you talk about the alternative press and so on, I don't understand why no more effort is taken to get people other than the privileged sector of American society, those who have tenures, who have very good educations or who retired, into activism, as you would like to call it. I gave a lecture at the University of Southern California last year, and I got two of the three bellhops in my hotel to come along to the audience, one of whom was in the reserves. I've got quite a lot, when I'm flying on domestic airlines, apart from after I've had my random security check, I meet a lot of people on planes, and I bring them in, come to my lecture. I got a whole Air France crew the other day, unfortunately, they all agree with me, of course. But I don't think, and also there's a certain snobbishness here, I mean, very nasty. I've heard several times in the last year, and I do trips here, say, every 3.5 weeks, people say, "Oh, well, those people, they have so little information." I did an Amtrak trip down to Duluth in Georgia, and I tell you, the buffet car crew and the car crew in that train were very well versed on the Middle East. They knew exactly what was happening. They were very interested in the story I was doing. We talked for something like 2 or 3 hours, and they were talking just as much as me, a rare occasion. But it's important, I think, you don't reach out to people outside. I mean, I'm not saying you're class conscious. We're the big class conscious kind.
We want to take one more question, and you can put the information afterwards for people to share it.
Go ahead,
please. I know, everybody. So I just had a question. Well, thank you for everything you said today. If America goes to war with Iraq, how does this affect Israel and Palestinian conflict? I mean, you hear a lot of Israelis using that as for ethnic cleansing.
Yeah, and there are Israeli academics who fear it's true and have written letters with large numbers of signatures at the end saying they believe that is a great fear. I rather think it won't happen. You know, what's going on if you actually go to the West Bank and Israel is that people are already moving. Hundreds of Christians from Bethlehem are going on long holidays and not coming back. I should add that quite a lot of Israelis I know have gone on long holidays and haven't come back. People are leaving. I mean, particularly Christians from Bethlehem, many people can't come back. And as the villages are nibbled into, the process is underway. It's not like something that's going to happen if there's a war. It is happening now. It's also happening, it's most unfortunate that in many cases, the Israelis who are leaving are not coming back, or are taking extended holidays and then buying a house. These, in many cases, are the better educated and, I would say, liberal, but, you know, less extreme elements of the society. And it may well be that it's the same point actually the same issue among Palestinians, although I'm pushing my luck a bit with that theory. You know, I think one of the issues about the Gulf War is that however much we loathe Saddam, right? I mean, anyone who says he unbehabbik ya Saddam is out of his mind, frankly. I love Saddam, so there's this precarious. And but Palestinians do say and do feel that Iraq could still be the most powerful Arab country, and it could be the only country that could get them any kind of liberation, and it is being going to be destroyed for that reason. You know, those of you who are not from the region should realize that all Arab countries either have water or oil. The only Arab country that's got water and oil is Iraq. And thus you have this kind of golden glow towards Iraq, not towards Saddam and the ghastly Ba'ath Party, but towards Iraq as a country. And the reason why Arabs are so fearful of what's going to happen is not because they care about Saddam. They wonder why it's happening. And I do think that there is a direct connection. I mean, you know, never has Israel had such friends within the administration. When you can have Rumsfeld talking about the so-called occupied territories and have Bush calling Sharon a man of peace. I mean, don't call Arafat a man of peace, but don't call Sharon a man of peace. You know, it's a very dangerous time. I mean, every day a linguistic precedent is set by the US administration, which would be astonishing 5 or 6 years ago. We wouldn't believe it. The things that are being said. You know, when Sharon's Air Force bombed Gaza and killed, was it 9 children among the people in the building, and Sharon calls it a great success and America calls it heavy-handed, something has gone wrong with the moral compass of the West. It gets away with it. And if this is the country that's going to, this is the country that allows this, is going to invade Iraq, what future is for the Palestinians? My father was a soldier in the First World War. He was much older than my mother. He fought in the Third Battle of the Somme in 1918. When he died, I had his campaign medal. And on the back it said, "The Great War for Civilization." And as the years went by, my father died at the age of 93 in 1992. He came to hate the war he'd fought in and felt it was utterly useless, not least because, of course, it had to be fought all over again between 1939 and 1945. But what I have noticed from it is that the war my father fought in produced victors who had an arrogance of power that has brought nothing but the malignity of history and endless death to those they wished to control. Because in the years 1920 and 1921 that followed the First World War, in a period of just 17 months, the victors of that war created the borders of Northern Ireland, Yugoslavia, and the Middle East. And I have spent my entire professional career watching the people inside those borders burn. And that's why I worry about another man who's going to have a war for civilization and liberation and is going to recarve up more borders for the future. And that's why I think the Palestinians are in danger, yeah.
You've been listening to a talk by Robert Fisk, foreign correspondent for the London Independent. The talk was recorded on February 5th, 2003 in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thanks to Martin Volker of No U-Turn Radio for that tape. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. To contact the program or view our archives of previous shows, visit our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, numeral 4, ALL.org/unwelcome.